ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Mining and farming are central to regional Australia, industries that are the lifeblood of towns and communities right across the country. But today on Australia-wide, we'll look at the emergence of a more modern style of mining and farming in regional Australia, cryptocurrency mining and crypto farming.
It was out of control. I think we were both on the verge of our wives going, enough's enough. It's us or the crypto miners kind of thing. So Andy and I put our heads together and said, hey, let's do this. Let's build our first farm.
And on the south coast of WA, we'll meet a man who breaks the law almost every day. He, like many other Australians, is prescribed medication to manage chronic pain and fatigue. But because that prescription is for medicinal cannabis, he's not legally allowed to drive with the drug in his system, even if he's not intoxicated at the time. It's a legal conundrum for him and thousands of others, and advocates say it's time for the laws to change.
We've enshrined in law a lie which states that any presence of detectable THC is equivalent to impairment.
I'm Alex Hyman, and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Whadjuk Country, Perth. The world's most recognisable cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, has hit record highs in recent weeks. This is good news to those investing in the often turbulent digital currency, but it also gives new hope to crypto miners keen to make their operations profitable. Business reporter Amelia Turzon has been looking into what this price surge has meant for Bitcoin mining operations here in Australia. Amelia, even though Bitcoin and cryptocurrency have been around for many years now, it's something that still confuses a lot of us, me included. Can you explain how Bitcoin is mined and how do miners make money from it?
So to even go back even further, what Bitcoin is, it's a decentralized currency. So if you think about the Australian dollar, it's overseen by central banks. It has financial types involved in the system. Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, they've been set up by codes. Bitcoin itself was launched in 2009 by an unknown operator. And instead of the central bank idea, it requires lots and lots of coding to be operated and for transactions to take place between people in Bitcoin. That's often talked about as the blockchain. So when it comes to mining, and I only figured this out when I was doing this story, so I think this is how quite unusual this whole thing is that Bitcoin mining is the process by which data centers or computers are authorizing or helping out with the transactions of that Bitcoin in that coding process. So are you still with me down there?
I am. Sort of like a crowdsourced arrangement somewhat.
Essentially, yes, it's like a crowdsourcing arrangement, or as one Bitcoin mining academic said to me, it's almost like operating the infrastructure of the internet. So, of course, you need lots of computers to do this, but they need an incentive, right? And that is where Bitcoin mining comes into play. Originally, when it started out, I was hearing from people involved in Bitcoin mining that you could just do it on your computer, right? Like this is years ago. And every 10 minutes or so, a code is generated by the Bitcoin protocol and it spits out this code and the first computer to guess what that code is gets rewarded with Bitcoin. So over the years, as the price of Bitcoin has surged and also over the years as more and more of them have been released by this mining process, getting access to that coding has gotten more and more complex. So you can no longer do this at home on your laptop. I've been talking to Bitcoin miners who started off doing home mining, as they call it, and then over the years they've had to add what they call rigs or really big computing systems. And now you have this as being this massive industry. I also interviewed the boss of a NASDAQ-listed company that's from Australia. They have these 5 mega facilities doing this in Texas and in Canada. So that's the beginning, and here we are today. Bitcoin mining is a major industry.
And what sort of returns are we talking about? Is it very profitable?
So it's been difficult to ascertain the real margins that Bitcoin miners are working on. One specialist academic that I spoke to described it as marginally profitable. And he also described it as something that you shouldn't be thinking of as a get-rich-quick scheme. It's obviously very, very, very competitive, especially at the moment when the price of Bitcoin is, close to 70,000 US dollars or 100,000 in our currency. He estimates there's millions, if not tens of millions of computers out there competing at the moment. And only one wins every 10 minutes and the best technology wins, which is why obviously you can't do it on your laptop at home anymore. But I did speak to two blokes, well, they're oil and gas miners actually from WA who started out as home miners many, many years ago and have actually scaled up. Here is a little bit of Russ speaking to me about their Bitcoin mining journey.
Both Andy and I come from a home mining background. So I started mining on a program called Unminable on my PC at home. So I rapidly started growing more mining rigs. So I was building PC rigs and mining through that way. And then I started researching more and started buying more equipment, and then lo and behold, Andy was doing the same. We were working together at the time and didn't know each other were mining, and it was just a conversation that was had in the office that got us both talking. And he's like, oh, you mine crypto, Russ? And I'm like, yeah, you know. And he was telling me his story, and we you know, from that point on we were just going month by month, and so saying what we were adding. Oh, I've just added this rig, I've just built this GPU rig, and we got too big for home and it was out of control. I think we were both on the verge of our wives going, enough's enough. It's us or the crypto miners kind of thing. So Andy and I put our heads together and said, hey, let's do this. Let's build our first farm.
That's Russell Willans, the co-founder of MetaMining, a Bitcoin mining operation based in regional WA. We are speaking with our business reporter, Amelia Turzon, about the price surge of Bitcoin and how that price rise is influencing so-called Bitmining operations here in Australia. Now, Amelia, just how involved is the mining? We heard there that you can no longer do it on your home computer or a single laptop. It requires a bit more than that these days. What is required as far as technology, data and the energy to do the mining?
So as Russ said there, they started what they call, quote, a farm. I've actually seen vision of it. It's at a secret location in WA. He can't reveal where it is, but it's basically a bunch of shipping containers filled with masses of technology. They look like, I guess in a sense, big boxes with exhausts and very, very energy intensive. In fact, Bitcoin mining has had a really bad rap the last couple of years as it's become more widely talked about in the media for just how energy intensive it is. Here is what Russ said when I talked to him about their energy usage.
There's obviously massive power needs and that heat loading and all the noise and everything associated with it. So it's not something you can easily do on scale, you know, in your home or even in a residential situation, because you'll have neighbour complaints and all sorts anyway. We've got these locations that we've got power providers that we've partnered with here in WA. So they've built infrastructure such as solar and wind farms, and we're piggybacking off that green energy.
So that's Russ talking about how they power their facility. Russ says they're not entirely just in it for the money here. They're real crypto enthusiasts and they really love supporting the system. However, they do want to mine enough Bitcoin so that they can cash out at what they think will be the high. When you speak to those really, really big companies, though, that I was talking about, one company called Iron, they have these five facilities in Canada and Texas, and their power usage is just off scale. They say that they're using purely hydropower in Canada to make that work, and also a combination of other renewables down in Texas. But when I asked them about how this stacks up economically, they said that currently at the high price of Bitcoin, they make a profit from mining the Bitcoin, what they get versus their power bill. But their power bill was something like several million. for in US dollars for just 1 month alone. So a lot of money there. And as I mentioned, economists aren't entirely sure how big bucks you're going to get off this. They say it's marginally profitable. And obviously, the bigger scale you have, the harder it is for the small guys to compete with you and get their Bitcoin as well.
And one thing that may be an issue for some of these operations, for people who have been following the Bitcoin market, they may have heard of something known as the halvening, which is approaching. Can you explain what that is and when it's expected to happen?
Sounds like something out of a sci-fi film, doesn't it? The halvening. So the halvening is this thing that happens every 4 years or so as generated by the Bitcoin code. As I mentioned, at the moment, every 10 minutes, there's a code that's spewed out by the system. The person who solves the puzzle first wins an allotment of Bitcoin. Currently, that's 6.25 Bitcoins, which works out to... God, don't make me do the numbers. A lot of money, about $300,000. But in the halvening, what happens, as it might suggest, is that number will drop by half. So from around May, it's expected that allotment will go down to just over 3 Bitcoin. And then 4 years later, the allotment will halve even further. And there's only a finite amount of Bitcoin to ever be spewed out by the system, around 21 million. And so far, so much has been spewed out at this exponential rate that there's only just over around 1 million left. It's expected that they'll be slowly expelled by the system over the next, 100 years, which really calls into question, how do you have a business model that's based around, a declining resource that will run out one day, which is something I put to the big Bitcoin miners. And it turns out they also think that they can survive financially off these extra fees that they get from the Bitcoin system for processing transactions. So there's a second revenue stream, although academics say it's nowhere near as big as mining. So a very complex economic puzzle here. And it also must be said that this is all set on, one, the Bitcoin price being high. And as we know, it's incredibly volatile and it's crashed several times. It also requires people to keep believing in Bitcoin and using it. Some economists that I've spoken to describe it as inherently speculative and, as one person said to me, basically pointless. So no one really knows as well if Bitcoin's going to stick around, right? It's been bubbling along for now for 15 years, but some economists still believe that one day it might disappear. Others that I spoke to say, who knows, the jury is still out.
Amelia, you mentioned there that we are seeing these record prices in the last few weeks. So what sort of feedback on that did you get from some of these operators here in Australia?
Well, they're obviously pretty stoked. The smaller miners like Russ and his co-founder, Andy, say that they have actually been inundated with queries from other people who want to get mining at the moment. As well as having their own facility, they also have a small company that helps other people with technology. So as you can imagine, the price is soaring at the moment and people want a piece of that. Although, as economists mentioned to me, it is not a get rich quick scheme. It's actually quite hard to do. The other company, the really, really big one that I spoke to, is obviously also very excited that the Bitcoin price is high. Again, it will be said, though, they made a $260 million loss last financial year. That was after write-downs and as the Bitcoin price was going down. So a lot of volatility still in this market, but currently people seem excited.
It's absolutely fascinating. Our business reporter is Amelia Turzon. Amelia, thanks so much for speaking to Australia Wide.
Thank you.
You're listening to Australia Wide. On ABC Radio.
You are listening to Australia Wide with me, Alex Hyman. It's great to have your company. In recent years, the uptake of legal cannabis for medicinal use has been huge. As of January 2024, the Australian Health Practitioner Regulation Agency puts the number of medicinal cannabis patients at more than 1 million. However, in most parts of the country, it is still illegal to drive if you have cannabis detectable in your system, even if you have a prescription. It's a conundrum that has many Australians forced into making a difficult choice: forego their medication, give up driving, or break the law. Advocates say cannabis is unfairly targeted by this legislation, and new research suggests patients who regularly take cannabis are safely able to drive. From Albany on the southern coast of WA, Jamie Tanu reports.
Every year, hundreds of thousands of Australians take medicinal cannabis. John, a West Australian man who does not wish to use his real name, is one of them. He has been taking prescribed medicinal cannabis to treat his chronic fatigue, and he says that without it, he'd be stuck in his bed.
It's just been like revolutionary. My main problem has been fatigue and just inability to get moving, and it helps with that, so it's just wonderful. In terms of like well-being and quality of life, it's made an enormous difference.
He says it lets him live a normal life. Yet, at the same time, there is one very large part of his normal day he's meant to avoid. That's because in Western Australia, like most of the country, it's illegal for anyone to drive with THC in their system, even if they have a prescription. THC, tetrahydrocannabinol, is the intoxicating compound found in cannabis, and with John taking his medication each day, it's likely it would be caught in his system if he was tested. Despite this, it's a law he ignores.
I just don't think I should sacrifice driving just because of medicinal cannabis, basically. Really, yeah, it's so simple. I'm an experienced driver. I'm also experienced with cannabis. When you have a tolerance like I do, it's not as strong. It doesn't affect you so bad.
New research from Swinburne University appears to back up John's claim. Experts put 40 subjects, all patients who regularly take medicinal cannabis, behind the wheel of a driving simulator before and after giving them a dose. Dr. Thomas Arkell is part of the Swinburne team.
Our main finding was remarkably little change in driving performance before and after people had taken their medical cannabis.
The researchers believe patients may build up a tolerance over time as they take their cannabis medication. And this may be especially relevant in Australia.
And Australia is quite unique for this and probably the best place to do some of this research because we have a very regulated medical cannabis system.
In Australia, unlike the United States, for example, your doctor gives you a prescription for a specific cannabis product, and those are the only ones that you can take. So it may be that Australian patients are more likely to get used to the cannabis that they are taking.
And we see this with other medications aside from cannabis. Certain medications can cause impairment at first when people are not used to those effects.
In fact, it is something that happens with drugs you can legally drive on. For instance, antidepressants and opioids.
We don't treat any other prescription medication in the same way, where you can be pulled over and it can be an offence to simply have that drug in your system.
Tasmania is the only part of Australia where a patient can drive after consuming THC, as long as they can show they have a prescription and aren't impaired. The question is if the rest of the country's laws are based on fact or assumption. According to Australia's legalised cannabis parties, it's clearly the latter. WAMP Dr. Brian Walker says it's time for change.
We've enshrined in law a lie which states that any presence of detectable THC is equivalent to impairment.
The Western Australian government has suggested it is open to amending the law so that a patient with a prescription can legally drive with THC in their system. A state government spokesperson told us the Minister for Health is consulting with health experts on the matter. WA's Department of Health meanwhile recommends that patients do not drive while on medicinal cannabis. It says this stance is based on current medical consensus and that new research, such as the Swinburne team study, needs to be carefully assessed.
I'm not sure that the evidence that we have here is sufficient to go ahead and change any laws, but it's really the first bit of evidence to say that, well, maybe patients that are using cannabis as prescribed are not impacted us in the way that we may think they might be.
Meanwhile, John hopes eventually the law will be changed.
Well, I wish to be able to drive without fear of being prosecuted for, just because I'm on medicine that I need. It's really good for my well-being, my functioning.
Thanks to our reporter Jamie Tanu for that story from WA's Great Southern Region.
ABC Australia Wide.
And finally here on Australia Wide. Shanae grew up writing music in the paddocks of her family's Ongerup farm, nearly 5 hours southeast of Perth. But when tragedy struck her family, Shanae's dreams of becoming a singer faded into the background. After having three boys and moving to a property in the southwest, Shanae has picked up her guitar again and headed to the country music capital of the world to take back her dream.
My childhood was incredible. When I think about the farm and growing up, a lot of my days were spent out in the paddock, singing, playing, out in the bush. We played a lot in the bush.
Growing up, Sinead Johnston's farm was her stage, and she had big dreams to make it as a singer.
I just wanted people to watch me. I just wanted to sing. I wanted to put on shows. I wanted to sing at school, yeah, community events. I was just always singing, and I was well known in the Ongarup community for my singing.
Music had come out of her since she was a little girl, but at 19, the music stopped.
I had a really, really challenging year. I lost my mum, and that was devastating. And there was a lot of trauma there. Yeah, it chokes me up still when I think about how much I struggled, because she was, you know, like she just thought, I mean, every parent thinks that their child is the best singer in the world, but she thought I was just so talented, and she just gave me every opportunity. You know, she was driving me around the countryside to competitions. She just wanted me to be heard. And losing her was so hard, and the grief was so, I stopped singing. I think the trauma of that, of losing her, was so hard. I just did not want to sing.
Sinead met her husband, they had three kids, and her life filled up with the full-time care of her new babies.
So we have three boys, and we definitely wanted them to grow up in the country and have the space. We found this place, and even though we didn't know anybody, we just jumped and we bought it, and yeah, we haven't looked back.
I'm talking to Sinead on her sprawling bushy property next to an orange tree.
They're not ripe yet, they're quite green. But that tree in a few months will be bright orange. That one over there's a fig tree. There's two mulberry trees over there.
It was coming back to the bush that brought the music back into Sinead's life.
When we moved down to Boyup Brook, I mean, I'd always loved country music, but when we moved down to Boyup, I just got right into it again. Like, I just wanted to listen to country music 24/7. I started picking up my guitar, I started playing more, started singing more. Some of the best stuff that I've written has been out in the bush.
Why do you think that is?
I think my best creativity is when I'm in solitude. So when I'm on my own, out in nature, listening to the animals, listening to the water, I just feel like it takes you to a different place.
We packed up the car and we drove to a little town, 3 hours south of the city, breathing in that fresh country air and meeting strangers' warm stairs.
She's giving it a red-hot go and heading to the songwriting capital of the world to record an EP.
My husband, when I, you know, said to him, I want to do this properly, I want it to have that country sound, I want to do this in Nashville, I think he thought I was mad and, who are you? Like, he just didn't get it. He was like, where is this coming from? Like, you haven't been singing the whole time. Like, he just didn't know this. He'd heard about it from other people, but I hadn't shown him what I could do.
Sinead's found some sort of therapeutic resource getting back to the country.
I am doing it for myself, like first and foremost, because I believe that I'm a good singer and I can write great songs and I've got a lot to say. But I guess in a way, I was so supported by my mother and my family with my music. And I feel like I'm not doing it for her, but I feel like, well, I guess maybe in some ways I am. I'm continuing on with something that I know she was so proud of, you know, and I think that she would be so, so happy to know that I'm doing this. Yeah, I think she would just be so thrilled and excited, and it's almost like I can hear her, you know, like fist pumping.
How the story ends when you already know.
A bit of hair like stuck in my mouth. the wind, like, just blowing my
hair. The wind was a paid actor.
That story by Amelia Searson with additional production from Elsa Silberstein. And that is Australia Wired for this Wednesday. I'm Alex Hyman. I'll be back again with you tomorrow. I look forward to your company then. Have a wonderful evening. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.